A year ago, Syrians took to the streets. Emboldened by the Arab Spring uprisings in the region, thousands began protesting against the rule of President Bashar al-Assad. The birthplace of the rebellion is the city of Daraa, where a police operation to find children who'd written anti-Assad graffiti turned into a demonstration by a whole community. As the protests spread, President Assad sent in his military to clamp down, and the peaceful protests were met with lethal violence. That spurred more unrest throughout the country. The United Nations estimates the Syrian army has killed more than 8,000 people and has displaced more than 200,000. That number, of course, difficult to verify. The country has mostly been cut off to international media. Of those journalists who have got through, some have paid with their lives. Amateur video posted on the internet tells a story of deliberate targeting of civilian areas by tanks and snipers. But the Syrian government insists it's fighting armed terrorists. Here's Syrian Foreign Ministry spokesman Jihad Makdisi.
The Syrian army is not on the offensive side. It is on the defensive side. We should stop the blame game and give the go-ahead for the political process. And this is the only solution to overcome our painful crisis.
Two rebel towns, Homs and Idlib, have been bombarded and largely regained by Syrian government forces. Daraa is reported to be under attack now. And those fleeing the fighting or trying to resupply the rebel Free Syrian Army face a new and deadly obstacle, landmines. Jonathan Head is the correspondent for our partner, the BBC, and he joined us earlier from a refugee camp in Turkey close to the Syrian border. Here's his update.
Well, this is one of seven refugee camps set up by the Turkish authorities very close to the Syrian border. I mean, behind me there's a sort of forested hills, and there's only about a mile or so that way is the Syrian border. This one in front of me now has a total of 7,500 people in it. It was established last year when the first trickle of refugees came over. It's pretty full now. It's quiet at the moment, but there have been protesting here to mark the 1 year since the uprising began in Syria. All these people have fled across the border from Idlib province, just over on the other side. It's an opposition stronghold. And all the young men in this camp tend to get involved in activities to try to help the Free Syrian Army insurgents who are still on the other side, carrying food and medical supplies through smuggling routes to get back that way. So it's very much a hotbed of resistance, this camp. It is managed by the Turkish authorities. They try to control it fairly carefully. But these people get out every now and again and try and do what they can to keep their struggle against President Assad going.
Are people still able to cross that border? Because it's been reported there are landmines now sown there.
Yes, there are, Dan, and actually quite close to where I am. I mean, they're patchy the landmines, but they're a real hazard for refugees coming out. They're not everywhere, but people don't know where they are. And you know, it's really not far from me. There are Syrian forces moving around quite quickly. It changes from day to day. So the routes in and out, one moment you can get in and out, the next moment it becomes very dangerous. And these young men who go backwards and forwards across the border, and there are quite a lot of them, really do take enormous risks. I mean, they accept that, you know, they could end up being killed going across the border. For the people, the families coming across, obviously the women and children stay here. The ones trying to come across, it's a horrible journey. It really is. The border is crossable in quite a few places. That sometimes it's a barbed wire fence, sometimes it's a river. But getting to the border is the real risk now, because the Syrian forces on the other side, aside from the landmines, they pretty much shoot at anything that moves. And almost all the refugee groups we've spoken to have described, you know, the large family groups with women and children with them, they've described being fired at as they try and make their way to the border.
And they say that they're abandoned, as you told us. One of the ideas that had been talked about was to create some kind of buffer zone from where you are, pushing maybe only a few kilometres inside Syria. That, from what you're telling us, that would be a hotly contested project.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, people here would love that, you know, that because it would enable them to keep their resistance going. I mean, there are Free Syrian Army camps literally just inside the Syrian border, but right under the noses of Turkish bases, and they probably wouldn't be attacked. But they can't do very much. You know, all the young men here say, if we had that, we could fight back. We'd have some kind of base to fight back from. But the reality is that will only happen if a government is willing to do it. The only government that could is Turkey. And for all of Turkey's strong rhetoric against President Assad, I mean, there's real hostility to him and anger, both in the government and the public here, about the killings that are going on there. They just realise that putting their troops in to try and enforce a buffer zone could backfire on them catastrophically. And Turkey is as cautious as any other country. The government says, yes, we want to do something, but we won't unless there's some kind of United Nations resolution to give us international cover, and unless we're doing it with other partners. And frankly, nobody else wants to take the risk of getting militarily involved.
Jonathan Head, correspondent for our partner, the BBC, joining us earlier from a Syrian refugee camp in Turkey, right on the Syrian border. The problem for the international community is that they can't agree on a solution. They see those videos of the civilian areas being bombarded. They know that there is an opposition and it's armed, but which kind of opposition and where will it drive Syria if it's successful? That's one of the discussions underway, and we can get some help with that idea from Samir Aita, Syrian opposition leader, founder of the Syria Democratic Forum in Paris. Samir, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway. Deal with that problem, that the international community, they seem not to know what they would get if they back the Free Syrian Army, if they back your opposition group. They don't know what would come next.
In fact, from the startup, the Syrian people have shown to be truly free, which means demonstrating, defying the military forces, and struggling for their freedom, their justice, and so on. And one region coming to help another region with the demonstrations, so showing a big sense of unity. And this movement is mostly a social movement, not a political movement, and all the political opponents, all the political parties, the SNC, and etc., are somehow far away from this social movement. And the foreign countries are divided. Bashar Assad has two crimes, one killing the people and the other putting Syria as it was in the 1950s, struggle for power in Syria. So you have the Chinese and the Russians on one side, you have the Friends of Syria, on the other side, all wanting to push Syria as a whole to their positions. Even within the Friends of Syria, you have fightings, meaning somehow, on one sense, that the Gulf countries want to change the political economy and the political positioning of Syria as a whole, while Turkey has interests, while Turkey has difficulties, and the things become complicated with this international fights and arena, complicating the life of the people and precisely making divisions within the opposition. It's not because the opposition is divided only, it's because each of the opposition group is pushed or backed by some superpower or regional power.
And no alternative leader has emerged. That's the problem, isn't it?
No. The SNC has been designed as a forum in the beginning, but became an exclusive group. In fact, I'm not in a group, a political group. We created a forum to make all these groups splitting apart to discuss together.
Exactly, but the discussions go on. But meanwhile, the people go on suffering. Samir Aita, Syrian opposition leader, he's in Paris. Samir, we've spoken about the political ideas. You said it's a social uprising. Let's try and deal in the few minutes we have with the practical help that Syrians outside Syria are now able to offer, because we've heard from Jonathan Head on the border there the terrible conditions in which those who can flee are having to suffer, and many people cannot flee. They're being moved around the country, living like refugees inside their own nation. What kind of help, actually practical help, getting help to those people, can people like you afford and achieve?
Most of the Syrians outside living outside the country, and there is a lot of them, maybe there is more Syrians living outside the country than inside Syria, are helping, are sending food, are sending money to their families to get the people making this uprising. It's 1 year with the economy collapsed, and one should wonder how all these young people or these demonstrators are getting through their lives while opposing the government. So this is very nice. The other side.
And how do you get that? Sorry, how do you get that through? How do you get the money through, for example? Because the sanctions mean Syrian banks are more or less isolated now.
Even before these events, 30% of the Syrian economy was informal, which means not getting through the usual normal routes. Now, 80% of the Syrian economy is informal, so you can get money, you can get whatever you want in Syria. You have all the goods inside the country, and the problem is to get these goods inside the blocked areas like Bab Amru or Idlib.
And in terms of supporting the Free Syrian Army, is there more and more effort, and is that successful, to get the kind of support that they might need to go on fighting?
The Free Syrian Army is mainly demonstrators who took arms, weapons to defend themselves, and some of the defectors. It's not really an army in the proper sense, and does not depend on its leader, who is today in Turkey.
But it needs ammunition, and it needs radios to be able to communicate, because one of the problems is they don't know where the Syrian army is at any one time.
It needs radios, it needs food, it needs for the weapons, bullets, and many things. And this is somehow coming inside in a reasonable way. What this is different from some fighting groups financed by the Gulf countries who are also here, and some also other groups than the Syrian Free Army, who are just smugglers and etc., taking profit of the chaos and making their things. So what is important and what was pushed is to constitute locally local administrations voted and elected by the people, to make somehow the control and to make all these military personnel depending on the civilians.
Which is probably a sign that this is going to go on for perhaps another year. Samir Aita, thanks. Syrian opposition leader speaking to us from Paris. He's founder of the Syria Democratic Forum. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.